So what does your family drama look like? My name is Bobby. I'm the pastor of Community Life here at Ross Road. And that's a question I ask people in the marriage preparation course that I do for couples who are about to get married, because likely what happened in their childhood, the way that they had conflict in their household, is likely what they'll bring into their marriage. For some families, that's very explosive and loud and confrontational. And for other families, they bury stuff, they don't talk about it, and let it fester for a long time. So it's good to talk about this, because what happens with parents, it's likely to happen in their kids. So it's good to have this on the table beforehand. Now, this isn't the only thing that parents pass on to their kids. As I see in my own life, the way that my kids talk and react to different things, I see that, oh yeah, they get that from me. Whether that's them being impatient with their brother or sister in the morning when we're getting ready, I go, oh, I sometimes say that. Or maybe when they talk to the referees on the TV and I go, oh, I might have said that same thing in the past. Parents will pass on to their kids different things. And the same is true in David's story and in his life. And no matter what the family drama that is going on in your life, I'm willing to bet that it doesn't compare to David's family drama. Now, to catch you up, we've been going through a series on David throughout his life, and this is later on in his life. And just last week, Pastor Craig talked about the story of David and Bathsheba, where David chose to sleep with Bathsheba, who was Uriah the Hittite's wife. Bathsheba becomes pregnant, and David decides to have Uriah killed in battle so that he doesn't have to deal with the consequences of committing adultery with Bathsheba. But to close that, Nathan comes and confronts David, and he gives this prophecy from God saying, hey, because you sinned, there's going to be consequences for that. And one of the things that he says is in 2 Samuel 12:10, now therefore the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. Now, this is going to come to fruition in David's life in a number of different ways. We're going to actually skim over one of the most icky parts of this story in chapters 13 and 14. So if you don't like reading those hard parts of the Bible, definitely don't read 2 Samuel 13 to 14. I repeat, if you don't like the icky parts, don't read 2 Samuel 13 to 14. I say that because I now know that most of you will probably read 2 Samuel 13 to 14 this week, and I want to encourage you to read your Bibles more. So today we're going to be mostly looking at chapters 15 to 18, and in this we're going to see some of that family drama come up. But at the end of 13 to 14, Absalom, who is David's son, actually murders his brother, Amnon, so another one of David's sons. So then after that, Absalom runs away. For 3 years, he's hiding because he doesn't want his dad to do anything. And then David invites Absalom back to Jerusalem, where David is staying, but David doesn't talk to him for 2 more years. So this is 5 years where David doesn't have really any contact with Absalom. And then again, with some things that go on, David ends up meeting with Absalom. And this is how it ends in chapter 14. It says, so Joab went to the king and told him this. Then the king summoned Absalom, and he came in and bowed down with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So there's some reconciliation here, but did you get the hint that this isn't something where it's like a real father to son interaction where there's love and an embrace and caring of each other? Yeah, David kissed Absalom, but that was a lot more common in their days than it is in our days. And it was more as a symbol as being part of the kingdom, not part of the family. And one way that it shows that is that over and over again, it talks about David as king. Not David, his personal name, not even as his father. They said the king allowed Absalom to kind of just to live in Jerusalem. So we're going to see what Absalom does in the coming time and how he's actually going to try to usurp David as king. And again, we're going to do a quick bird's eye view over these 4 chapters, so we're going to skip around. So after you finish reading chapters 13 and 14, I invite you this week to read 15 to 18 to get the full picture of what happened with Absalom and David and this uprising that Absalom is going to start. But first, a little bit about Absalom. It says in chapter 14, 25 to 26, In all Israel, there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the top of his head to the sole of his feet, there was no blemish in him. Whenever he cut the hair of his head, he used to cut his hair once a year because it became too heavy for him. He'd weigh it, and its weight was 200 shekels by the royal standard. This is a guy who had appearance for him. He even had long, glorious hair, maybe like an ancient Fabio. But you can tell that he probably had a little bit of pride with this, not only because he had good looks, he had riches, he had money. But I don't know anyone who actually weighs their hair when they cut it. So obviously he took pride in his hair to kind of see, okay, how much did my hair weigh this year when I did it? One way or the other, you can see that Absalom was a good-looking person, and he really and this helped him as he started to actually try to usurp the throne from David. Because Absalom is about to start a rebellion, and it's stated in chapter 15, 1 to 6. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" He would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there's no representation of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me, and I would see that they receive justice." Also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him. Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice, and so he stole the hearts of the people of Israel. Now, Absalom actually did this for 4 years, going out with his people, which is what a king would do, having chariots and men all around him, and trying to tell people that, like, if I was king, this is how it would be. And again, he won the hearts of people. One thing that was kind of surprising to me as I read this is realizing that in 4,000 years, political campaigning hasn't changed all that much. I mean, still today, the political leaders say, if I was leader, you'd get what you want. The other guy can't give you what you want. It's only what I can give you. Now, this is what Absalom is doing, and he's lying. Like, David was seeing people and he was doing good things, but he was slandering David, saying bad things, and unfortunately, it worked for him. And then in a bold and confident move, what Absalom does is he just goes into Israel and announces he is king. He sends messengers all over the place because he's already garnered some support, and he knows that if he just says it confidently, it'll work. This is true today. When people say things confidently, we tend to believe them more. It's actually my trick on how to read Old Testament names. If I just say it confidently, people believe that that's the way that you're supposed to say it. You'll see it later today when I read some Old Testament names. But this is what Absalom does with becoming king of Israel. So, how did David respond? In chapter 15, 13 to 14, it says this. A messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom." Then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, "Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin on us and put the city to sword." David has to flee. Now, it was likely that David knew what was happening with Absalom. I mean, he was doing it for 4 years where he was going out and garnering the support of people. And it was likely that at least a few people came in and told him what was happening. But over ever since David and Bathsheba, the story of that happening, David takes this passive role and he just lets sin fester in his family and in his life until it grows. And when we allow sin to grow, it has consequences. When you don't deal with an issue, the issue will deal with you. And that's what happens with David and his family. So he's forced to leave his home. He's forced to leave his stronghold. He's forced to leave what he knows, and he has to go back to the wilderness. If you know the story of David, you know that he was in the wilderness for a long time, running from King Saul, who was trying to kill him. But now he's running from his own son. He's actually running from his own people because he was supposed to be king. He's running from his own army who is going to kill him. Now, David is eventually known as one of the greatest kings of all of Israel, but the people in his day wanted to kill him and to put somebody else in the throne. David was forced to leave, going back to the wilderness, even though it wasn't really his fault. Have you ever been in a place where you maybe got demoted at work or you got in trouble for something that wasn't you and you're reaping the consequences of something that you don't feel like you deserved? This is probably how David felt in this moment. How did you respond? Do you respond with revenge or bitterness or depression? What I really admire about David is that he chooses to submit to God. Even when he's going back to the wilderness, he submits to God and his will. He shows this clearly when the priests actually come out of Jerusalem with him to leave to go to the wilderness, and he has an interaction with them telling them to go back to Jerusalem. Now, and that's important because they brought the Ark of the Covenant, and if the Ark of the Covenant went with him, that's a symbol that God was with him, and that would help garner support for him as he goes to other people, other cities, other troops, and just getting that symbol of God being with you and God's priests being with you would have been really important for him to muster his troops. But this is what he says to the priests in chapter 15, 25 to 26. Then the king said to Zadok, the priest, "Take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he'll bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, 'I'm not pleased with you,' then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him." Now, David chose to trust in God as he was facing his wilderness season. He knew that he couldn't manipulate God. He couldn't bargain with God. He couldn't make God do anything. So he chose just to trust in him and his will, whether that was for good, where he'd go back to the city, or if it meant that he wouldn't, and it'd be for bad for him. There's a saying that often goes, "God helps those who help themselves." And this isn't actually a biblical term. Now, God wants us to be active. He wants us to love people. He wants us to care. He wants us to follow him. He wants us to do lots of things. But the saying kind of implies that we can make God do something for us if we do this. And that's just not true. God is sovereign and he is good and he will do what he wants. So a more accurate saying is God will help who he wants to help. Now, David knows this. So again, he doesn't try to manipulate or cause God to do anything. But what he does do is he submits. He surrenders. And the reason he can submit and surrender, why that's a good choice, is because he knows God. He knows his character. He knows that God is the good shepherd who will be with him in green pastures and quiet waters, but he'll also be with him as he goes through the valley of the shadow of death. David knows that he can submit and surrender to God because that is his best choice, because he knows who God is. So, David doesn't need to act like a caged animal and go crazy and seek revenge and bitterness. He can act like a sheep following his good shepherd and submit to God even in the wilderness. Because God cares. And one of the ways that God shows his care and love is through other people. And in the hard times, in the wilderness, people often show their true colors. Now, most of actually chapters 15 to 18 is interactions with different people who show whether they're either loyal to David or whether they're going to join the rebellion of David. And I think it's key to see how lots of how David was kind and had integrity in the past, how that shows up to help him in the present. So we're going to just kind of do a quick flyby again of some of these interactions to see how some people came to help David and how his integrity in the past and care for others in the past help him now. Chapter 15, verse 15 says, "The king's officials answered to him, 'Your servants are ready to do whatever our lord the king chooses.'" Those are the people in his household, the people that he talked with lots, and they wanted to follow him, even if that meant going to a place that would include war or death or hardship, out of the comfort of their own home. Now, If David was mean to these people, if he treated them harshly, if he gave them small rations of food, likely these people would be like, no, we're gonna go try out this new king and see if he's better. But likely, David showed his kindness and care for them, so they would follow David, even in these seasons. Another person who shows support to David is Ittai, and that's shown in verses 19 to 21. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You're a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday, and today shall I make you wander about with us when I do not know where I'm going? Go back and take your people with you. May the Lord show you kindness and faithfulness." But Ittai replied to the king, "As surely as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be." David would have shown kindness to Ittai in one way or another by being a refuge to him from wherever he was coming from. And now, as David is becoming a foreigner and a refugee, Ittai says, "You know what? You did it for me, so now I'm going to do it for you and to care for you." This happens with the priests, and it happens with the priest's sons who become messengers and spies. And it even happens with a woman who hides these messengers, who's an unnamed person who just helps, likely because she has enjoyed the reign of King David in one way or another. But one thing that's surprising is actually the number of foreigners who help David compared to the Israelites who help Absalom. Some of these are in chapter 17, verses 27 to 29. It says, "When David came to Mahanaim, Shobai son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzalia the Gileadite from Rogalim," just say confidently, "brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, sheep and cheese from cows, milk for David and his people to eat. For they said, 'The people have become exhausted and hungry and thirsty in the wilderness.'" There's these three seemingly wealthy people who come to help David, and two of them are really interesting. One is because one of them is an Ammonite who's actually some of the enemies of David. And David has just had wars against the Ammonites. But what David has done to the Ammonites is he chose not to slaughter all of them, which sometimes would happen in the ancient Near East, but he showed kindness to them. So in this moment, they chose to actually help him rather than hurt him. Now, another person is Machir from Lodabar. Now, you might recognize that name because that was the person who Mephibosheth was staying with. Now, a couple weeks ago, Pastor Craig talked about Mephibosheth, who was Saul's grandson, and David showed grace to him. And Mephibosheth was staying with Machir. So Machir would have heard how David showed unmerited grace to Mephibosheth, and now Machir is returning the favor to David. Over and over again, you're seeing in David's life that he showed kindness and love to others, and now some of these people are showing up and showing kindness to him. You've probably heard the golden rule, which comes from Matthew 7, to do for others what you wish they would do for you. And in this case, as David did for others, they're actually returning the favor and doing it for him, giving him kindness and showing him grace and giving him a refugee. But this isn't true for everyone. Not everyone treats David kindly or nicely. Some of them treat him rather harshly. In chapter 16, 5 to 8, we see Shimei come, and he actually curses David. It says, "As King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. As he cursed Shimei, said, 'Get out, you murderer, you scoundrel.'" Do you see the picture? There's this one guy who comes out and starts throwing rocks at an army. Now, I kind of liken this to when my kids come and they have like those tiny little squirt guns and they squirt me while I'm holding a huge hose. Now, it's only a water fight as much as I want it to be a water fight, because if I wanted to, I could spray them so much that they run inside and cry to their mother. Don't worry, I haven't done that yet. But the army could have destroyed this person very quickly and easily, and yet they don't. Shimei was saying that David was a murderer, and yet he could have murdered Saul, but he chose not to. He could have taken Saul's throne multiple times, but he chose to surrender and submit to God's will in the previous time he was in the wilderness, and he takes the same stance this time as well. He ends up saying to him in verses 11 and 12, David then said to Abishai and all of his officials, "My son, my own flesh and blood, is trying to kill me. How much more than this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look upon my misery and restore me to his covenant blessing instead of his curse today." David lets him continue to throw rocks at him and his army rather than taking vengeance. He's again submitting and surrendering to God. Now, David takes the curses from this person and he kind of brushes it off a little bit. But the deepest hurt and pain that David feels is from Absalom, his son, betraying him, and one of his closest counselors, Ahithophel, who also chooses to side with Absalom. Most scholars believe that Psalm 55 was written by David in this time, and we're just going to read a couple of the verses from that to feel David's anguish as he's being betrayed by not only his own son, but one of his close confidants. Here's 4 and 5, and then 12 to 14. "My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen on me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. If an enemy were insulting me, I could endure it. If a foe were rising against me, I could hide. But it is you, a man like myself, my companion, my close friend, with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship at the house of God as we walked about among the worshipers." David is feeling the pain of somebody, of two people very close to him, betraying him, wanting his own death, going against him rather than supporting him. David didn't deserve this from them. He didn't treat either of these people harshly. In fact, it doesn't even seem like either of them really had anything to gain in this attacking against David. Now, Ahithophel would have had the same role with Absalom as he did with David. And Absalom was actually likely the next person in line to be king when David died. But for some reason, they both wanted him to die. Now, I don't know if you've ever been hurt or betrayed by somebody really close to you, but that always hurts so much more than someone distant or maybe a distant friendship or maybe not even somebody who you know very well, as is shown with Shimei and David. Like, counselors never ask people coming into their offices, like, "How many people did you drive by this week that gave you an obscene gesture?" Or how many people cut in line at a coffee shop? Usually we can brush these off pretty quickly when people we don't know very well hurt us. But it's the people who are closest to us that have the impact to hurt us, to wound us deeply. And David is in this place where he's been wounded deeply by Ahithophel, one of his closest friends and confidants, and by his own son. He's been betrayed by those closest to him. Now, there's even other people in this story that it's almost, you're not sure whether they are on David's side or not. One instance of this is Ziba, who is the servant of Mephibosheth. Now, again, go back a couple weeks to hear that story. But it seems like, well, Ziba comes and he gives David some provisions and says Mephibosheth is actually going to be siding with Absalom. But later in the story, Mephibosheth kind of says the opposite. He says that he wanted to submit to David and to help him, but Ziba kind of backstabbed him in one way or another. Now, at the end of the story, it seems like Ziba was the one who was lying, but you're not really sure. It's kind of left hanging there. And I think that also happens sometimes in our lives. Like, the Bible is really real and authentic, that sometimes we're not sure about people's authenticity and whether they're telling us the truth or whether they're just trying to take advantage of people who are in wilderness seasons. And that shows up again and again and again, because sometimes it's hard to know who we can trust in the wilderness. Because some people may be loyal, some people may just want to help themselves, and some people may hurt us for reasons that we don't understand. But David chose to trust in the one that he knew he could understand. Psalm 118:8 says this, "It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in humans." David knows that he can trust in God no matter what. Because the hero in this story is not David. David actually doesn't do a lot throughout this story. Mostly he has this passive role where he allows things happen to him. And the most exemplary things that he does are actually ways that he submits, surrenders, or just goes along with whatever God's will is. Over and over and over again, God is the hero of this story. Again, we're gonna do another flyby to show some of the ways that God is the hero and how he was working in the background in ways that David may have noticed or not even noticed at the time. So first of all, Ahithophel, who was his closest counselor, his counsel was known as like one of the gods. Like, I don't know anyone who I would say that their counsel is so good that it's like one of the gods. But if I were to say it, I would probably take that person's advice all the time. And this person was siding with Absalom. So Absalom goes to Ahithophel and he asks him to give him some advice. And Ahithophel says, I'm going to go out right away and go attack David so that once he's dead, we don't have to worry about anyone else and everyone will just fall in place with you. Now, Absalom likes his advice, but actually chooses to also ask Hushai for advice as well. And Hushai, who is actually David's friend and kind of working behind the scenes as a spy, he says to do some different things. He says to take your time, garner some support, and then you go out and attack David. And surprisingly, Absalom takes Hushai's advice. It says this in chapter 17, verse 14. Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel. For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom." God caused the advice of Ahithophel, whose advice was known as that of the gods, to not be taken so that Absalom would do something that would eventually help David. Now, again, there's other things that happened throughout the story. There's the messengers who got through. There is the woman hiding those messengers and them being able to tell David what was going to happen to protect them. There was also all the troops that came to give them support. And as I said earlier, there was honey and curds and bowls and bedding. This was abundant supplies that just kind of came from people you wouldn't expect. God causing these people to help David in his time of need. Even the place that David went, which is called Mahanaim, is a place that Jacob named back in Genesis 32. And if you go read the story, he names it that after God's angel provides for him. And here God is providing and helping David. Then eventually there's a battle that starts between Absalom's men and between David's men. And it says this in chapter 18, verse 8. "The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest swallowed up more men that day than the sword." Now, for the Lord of the Rings fans out there, I don't think this was exactly Fangorn Forest, where the trees actually killed the orcs. But I believe what happened is that David's men, who would have been more experienced fighters, they would have been able to take advantage of the forest of the terrain more than the untrained men of Absalom. And Absalom also would have had a much larger army than David, but that large army wouldn't have been able to be used to the advantage in the forest as it would have been in a plain or a place that was open so that the forces could be used more advantageously. But here you see that even in the battle, that God is helping David's forces. And maybe the most clear and kind of ridiculous way that God comes through is in verse 9. It says, "Now Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's hair got caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair, while the mule he was riding kept on going." Do you remember that thick, lustrous hair that Absalom had? It kind of came to bite him later on because it got caught. And can you picture it just kind of hanging there? Like, David's men didn't even have to win the battle for David. He just kind of was sitting there hanging, long enough for a messenger to run off, go tell Joab, the leader of the army, and Joab to come back and see Absalom caught in a tree. God was causing things to work in David's favor behind the scenes. David knew that he could submit and surrender to God because he is good and he would care. Proverbs 19:21 says, "Many are the plans in a person's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails." David was trusting in God's purpose throughout his life, and especially in the wilderness seasons, as he did before and as he did now. That's true for David, and it's true for us, that God is working in us and for us in the background. Now, this doesn't mean that everything is good and it's always easy and it's always comfortable. If that's true, David wouldn't be in this situation. And over again, the New Testament says that we will face trouble, that there will be persecution, that there will be hardship in this world, but we can trust that God is with us through it. And as Pastor Craig talked about last week, that there is consequences to sin, because this whole thing happened because of David's sin with Bathsheba and Nathan's prophecy that the sword would not leave his house. And this is coming to fruition, because just like how David saw Bathsheba and wanted her and even killed his close friend so that he could have her, the same is kind of happening with Absalom, where he saw the kingship and he would be willing to kill even David to get it. Because wherever sin happens, there is consequences in our lives. Sometimes that sin done in us, sometimes that's the consequences of sin to the person who is sinning, sometimes that's consequences of the person being sinned against, and sometimes there's like a collateral damage to the people around. Sin has an effect on people both directly and indirectly, bringing hurt and pain and death. So the invitation is to just stay and trust in God with the wilderness season. Because God not only helps us with the consequences of sin and to get through those times, but through Jesus, he has taken the consequences away once and for all. Because David is a picture of the coming Messiah. He's a small glimpse of what will be the greatest king in all of Israel's history, who is Jesus. T. Anderson talked about the Davidic covenant and how that points to Jesus one day. And throughout this story, there's actually hints of a greater king to come that will defeat sin and death once and for all. For instance, in chapter 15, verse 30, it says, David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. Who else went up the Mount of Olives and was weeping on top of it? It was Jesus on the night he was betrayed. And just as David said, I'm going to submit and surrender to your will, Jesus said, not my will, but yours be done. And just as David was betrayed by his friend Ahithophel, and eventually Ahithophel actually went and hung himself, Jesus too was betrayed by Judas, who eventually went and hung himself. David went to the wilderness, and Jesus went to the cross. In the tomb for us. Now, David's enemy was a person, his own son, but Jesus' enemy was sin. It was brokenness. It was suffering. Jesus' enemy was death. And while David swept the treachery of his son under the rug, kind of ignoring it and being passive and until it kind of forced him to act, Jesus chose to act, not against us, not against the sin that is so deep in our bones, but he chose to act to defeat that sin for us, so that now we don't have to face the pain and suffering of sin in our lives. Jesus actively went to war against that sin. In 2 Samuel, later on in the story, we see that David wins and he actually gets to go back to Jerusalem. And so he's won the war to be king again, but there's still battles that happen with other people who are trying to take the throne. And we're kind of in that season right now, where there's still battles going on of things that are wanting to be king and lord of our lives. But our choice is to trust that God is with us, that he is faithful in these seasons. Deuteronomy 31:8 says this, "The Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged." And Isaiah 41:10 says, "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." If you're in a wilderness season right now, I just want to tell you, God is with you. He will never leave you. He will never forsake you. Though you may not be sure about the people that are loyal to you or going to help you, though your circumstances may be crumbling around you, hold on to God. Submit and surrender to Him because you know that He is your good shepherd who sent His Son to die for you so that you could be with Him, both now and forevermore. For you, I encourage you to hold on to these promises of God. Maybe it's one of the verses I've read today, or maybe it's a favorite verse of yourself. Just claiming that promise for your life. Let that be the foundation for you taking a step in your wilderness, wherever that may be. Because people may betray you. Your situation may get worse, but God is always on your side. Let's pray. God, I thank you that you are with us in our wilderness seasons and that you are good and you are caring and that you are kind. I thank you that you bring miraculous ways to shelter us, to support us, to help us through these hard times, and that we can trust that one day that we'll be with you forever. There'll be no more tears, there'll be no more pain, there'll be no more suffering, but find joy in you forevermore. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.